have this one case on our 10:30 docket. Hampton Vaughn versus Briscoe. The clerk will please announce counsel. Mr. Stoley.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Stoley, representing the SCI defendants. This is a default judgment case involving a judgment for about $1.2 million. As the court knows, review of default judgments is governed by the three-part test in the Craddock case. It is an abuse of discretion to fail to set aside a default judgment when the three Craddock factors have been met. In this case, they all have been met. The first factor is that the failure to answer was not due to intentional conduct or conscious indifference, but was rather a mistake or an accident. Under this test, the conduct must be worse than negligence. In other words, mere negligence is not a grounds to refuse to set aside the default judgment. It's got to be intentional conduct or conscious indifference. As the Supreme Court has said multiple times, it's got to be that the defendant knew it was sued but didn't care. And so under this test, the defendant only has to show that it only has to provide some excuse and not necessarily a good excuse. This test was satisfied here by the evidence. Mr. Farmer, the in-house counsel for SCI, thought that there would be a settlement meeting between his client, the Briscoe family, and the Briscoe family's lawyer. He believed that there would be this meeting to discuss settlement, that he would be contacted afterwards if it didn't settle. When he didn't hear anything, he tried multiple times to telephone plaintiff's counsel, never received a telephone call back, a return phone call. And plaintiff's counsel has never denied that he was phoned many times and did not return the phone calls. So what happened here was Mr. Farmer made a mistake. He assumed that this was a routine case. It was being handled on a routine basis, commensurate with the level of exposure and the nature of the case. Unfortunately, it didn't go that way. Mr. Farmer's handling was certainly not a model of superior lawyering, but it is some excuse, even if it's not a good excuse. Put a different way, Mr. Farmer did show some care. He showed that he cared about the lawsuit being properly handled. He tried to make sure that he was up to date by making phone calls to inquire. The plaintiffs even argue in their briefing that what happened here was Mr. Farmer didn't care enough to do this and he didn't care enough to do that. Well, that's an admission that he did care. He cared some. Not enough to satisfy them, but it's enough to satisfy the law. The second factor in Craddock is to set up a meritorious defense. In doing that, the court is only to look at the defendant's evidence of the meritorious defense. On the facts of this case, the SCI defendants have a much different story. That's one defense. As they laid out in the letter that's attached to an affidavit, the letter went to the Texas Funeral Services Commission to explain from the SCI defendant's perspective what happened here. They had a list of unclaimed remains, unclaimed ashes. Mr. Briscoe's name was on that list. Then they discovered that a temporary urn that was had contained his ashes was still in the storage room. So they were wondering, okay, why is he still on the list and why is the temporary urn still here, although the urn was empty? So out of an abundance of caution, they went to the Briscoe family to check it out to make sure that there wasn't anything wrong here, and they discovered there wasn't. The medallion in the urn at the Briscoe home was the correct medallion, identified by number to correspond with Mr. Briscoe's remains. So that's the factual defense. There's also factual defenses on damages. The damage evidence here clearly shows that the Briscoe family, the children, did not establish mental anguish, which is the only award given in the default judgment. They didn't show any kind of substantial disruption in daily routine or any sort of mental anguish more than mere worry, anxiety, or vexation. So, in fact, the evidence also shows that one of the plaintiffs who testified at the default hearing was not even Mr. Briscoe's child. She was a stepchild. So there's factual defenses on damages as well. In addition, there's contractual damage arguments, limitations on damages set forth in the contract, and the fact that only one defendant can be liable on the contract to one plaintiff rather than all the defendants being jointly and severally liable to all the plaintiffs. So there are multiple meritorious defenses here, and the law is you don't have to show that the result would be completely opposite from the default judgment that was entered, only that it would be a different result. The third factor is that there is no undue prejudice or delay to the plaintiffs by setting aside the default judgment. Once that has been alleged by the defendant, the burden shifts to the plaintiff to prove undue prejudice or delay. And the reason the burden shifts is that the knowledge of what is the prejudice or the delay or the cost is uniquely within the plaintiff's knowledge. So it's up to them to bring that forward to the court. Here, the SCI defendants alleged multiple times in their papers in the district court that the Craddock factors have been met, which would include the lack of undue delay or prejudice. So the burden shifted, and the Briscoe family didn't put on any evidence of, for example, the cost to obtain the default judgment or some kind of undue prejudice such as unavailability of evidence or witnesses. Now, there is one common misconception, I think, in the legal community that you have to, that the defendant has to offer to pay for the plaintiff's cost to obtain the default judgment, and the defendant has to offer to go to trial immediately. And that's a misconception because the Supreme Court has said multiple times, although those can be important factors, they are not dispositive. The failure to do that does not mean that this default judgment has to remain. So here the burden shifted and no evidence was presented by the Briscoe family to carry their burden after it was shifted. Also, the case law says that the defendant can, in fact, make the offer to reimburse for the defense, for the cost to obtain the default judgment, and can offer to go to trial immediately while on appeal. So the SCI defendants have done that in their reply brief, and I will repeat that offer today that the SCI defendants do offer to reimburse for the reasonable cost to obtain the default and do offer to go to trial without delay upon remand. So that satisfies all those arguments satisfy the third factor, which means all the factors have been satisfied and the default judgment should be set aside. Now, our alternative argument has to do with damages. The case law says that unliquidated damages still have to be supported by sufficient evidence and can be attacked on appeal from a default judgment for lack of sufficient evidence. If there is insufficient evidence, the remedy is to reverse for a new trial on damages only, and so that's why that's our alternative request. Here, the judgment awarded only mental anguish damages, without specifying which cause of action that was for, although it was multiple causes of action. And the award of $850,000 for mental anguish was a lump sum award given to the plaintiffs as a, quote, collective unit. And that's the word used in the default judgment, collective unit. So there's a number of flaws with this damages award, one of which is that the court awarded mental anguish for negligent misrepresentation. Under the law, damages for negligent misrepresentation are limited to the difference in value and pecuniary loss. So mental anguish is not recoverable, but it was nevertheless awarded. Also, as I've discussed earlier, at least with respect to the Briscoe children, there is no evidence of past mental anguish. There is no evidence of future mental anguish. So we have some plaintiffs at a minimum who were awarded mental anguish when they didn't prove mental anguish. Now, the case law says when you have a lump sum award like this and there are elements within that award that are clearly unsupported, the only thing the court can do is reverse and remand because you have no way to sort of tease out or separate out the damages that are invalid from those that might be valid. You don't have that kind of segregation spelled out, and you're unable to do that, so you have to reverse. That was done in two Houston cases, the Whitaker case and the Jackson case specifically, which are both default judgment cases. And, of course, that follows from the reasoning in the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Harris County versus Smith, that if you have proper damage elements commingled in a lump sum award with improper damage elements, you have to reverse because you cannot tell what amount to award as a proper damage award. So that's the
ultimate. How do you respond to Appley's statement that there was no recovery for the negligent misrepresentation cause of action?
The default judgment states.
The judgment itself.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The judgment itself.
Yes, the judgment itself says on page 25 of the record, on the claim of negligent misrepresentation, the court finds in favor of plaintiffs. And then on page 27, the court finds that the plaintiffs will suffer severe emotional distress and mental anguish due to the actions of the defendants, including but not limited to their fraud, their negligence, and their breach of contractual relationship. So although fraud, negligence, and breach of contract are specifically spelled out as a basis, before that it's prefaced by saying including but not limited to. So the award was specifically made earlier. The court found in favor of the plaintiffs for negligent misrepresentation, and the inclusive language in this paragraph on page 27 would include negligent misrepresentation. So in conclusion, there's a strong preference in Texas law that cases be decided on the merits. This case should be decided on the merits. It's an eminently defensible case on the facts, an eminently defensible case on damages. There are also contractual and legal defenses beyond that. The Briscoe family should certainly have their opportunity in front of a jury to try to establish liability and to prove that their damages indeed amount to $850,000. But as things stand right now, that award plus the attorney's fees totaling almost $1.2 million is a windfall for a procedural default. They really don't deserve to keep that. They deserve their day in court just like SCI deserves its day in court to put on its defenses and establish what happened and what would a proper amount of damages be if there is liability.
And can you clarify for me which defendant the contract was actually made with? Because we've got, what, four or five defendants?
Yes. Attached to the Rolfe's affidavit, and the Rolfe's affidavit is at page 43, there is the contract at page 49. And at the top, the seller is identified as Hampton Vaughn Crestview Memoria. I'm honestly not sure which defendant that is.
Okay.
But we do know from the contract there is one seller. So there should be one party, one defendant liable on the contract. There is quite a bit of confusion as to the various names of the defendants. Some of them are actually DBAs, et cetera. Some of them don't exist. But they've all been named, so out of an abundance of caution, we've brought this appeal on all their behalves. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stolling. Mr. Steimel?
Thank you. Looking back at the two affidavits that are in the record that I signed, I'm amazed that there's not a statement about the phone calls. As I understand the rules of proceeding before the court, I'm limited to my arguing based upon the facts as they appear in the record. So I'm going to do it that way. It's been stated by Mr. Farmer that he phoned my office a number of times during the spring of 08. At that point in time, he was approximately 2.5 months sour on the 45-day answer date extension that I gave him and signed. He goes on to state, he phoned to determine the status and no return calls or communication was received. And then he goes on to say that he did it a number of times also after the spring of 08. And so, again, he says later on, I did not receive any return call or communication at a time when he was getting up to the point that he was months. I think when I took the default judgment, it was 7.5 months after the time that his 45-day extension expired. And what he did was nothing. He did absolutely nothing. So you can think about, and I think it was reasonable to assume that the trial court thought about, ever how many times he has a phone slip, or there's a phone slip in my office, is an example of Mr. Farmer not caring. And then I want you to consider the fact that every time there's a phone slip in my office and I don't return a phone call, it means that I am missing an opportunity to have this meeting and get a payday for myself and for my clients. I won't argue outside the record, but it just that statement by Mr. Farmer just doesn't make sense. It's not practical. It doesn't make sense at all. Another thing about his affidavits that amaze me are these vague allusions to the fact that he assumed some kind of a meeting was going to occur. Well, I did respond to that assumption in my affidavit, and I said I never agreed that I would take any responsibility for setting up any kind of a meeting to discuss anything. And so it seems to me that that's strong evidence that Mr. Farmer just didn't care. He just didn't care about this case. He didn't tend to business. He was horrible in the way that he represented his clients. With regard to the third credit factor, today here in court, I apparently have now been offered reasonable costs to take the default. And that's the first time that offer has ever been made. If you look at the letter that is in the record, Mr. Schottmer states he anticipates that his client will offer $500 to compensate me and another attorney for the effort and time that we took to take the default judgment. And that particular statement is not an offer of anything. And I totally disagree with counsel when he makes a statement that it's not important that they make that offer. With regard to the burden to come forward with evidence that there should have been some statement or proof by us that the delay would cause harm, I believe there's ample evidence in the record, and I took time to detail the quotes from my clients in the reporter's record that talk about the difficulties that they've had. These people don't know whose remains are in the urn that they have. These people don't know where Mr. Briscoe's remains are, and these people will never know that. And they got closure when they got their judgment signed by Judge Brotherton. And to reopen that will obviously cause harm, and obviously there's going to be delay if a new trial is granted. Ms. Briscoe's test, I'll just tell you, there was not a dry eye in the courtroom the day that I took the default judgment, and that includes every human being that was in that courtroom. These kind of cases that deal with mishandled remains apparently occur fairly often, and mental anguish is the primary type of damage that is proven up. And mental anguish can be proven up by the testimony of a plaintiff. And mental anguish can be proven up by the testimony of third persons who observed the behavior of the plaintiffs. And I've given you all of that in my quotes that I put into the brief, that these people observed each other, and in particular, they observed Miss Briscoe. And she had more than just vexation. She had 6 months of depression. She had to take medication. She was treated by Dr. Sharp, and she even gave testimony in court that she's still having that problem. So it's far more that she went through than just mere vexation or worry or angst. With regard to the fact that the default judgment was taken and almost 2 months elapsed before they requested the record. Perhaps I got off track when I went into the Rule 240 and Rule 329 dissertation that I provided the court in my brief. But I do believe that they entered an appearance for all purposes when they appeared in their second motion. And I think that it doesn't matter that Judge Brotherton said it was an interlocutory judgment. It also doesn't matter that I non-suited the two defendants. I believe that Judge Brotherton striking their second supplement was proper and the correct ruling. And he so stated in his letter ruling to the court. I've talked some about damages. Judge Brotherton, in particular, in the reporter's record, delineated how he awarded the damages. He broke it out. I don't have it memorized off the top of my head, but he did separate the damages in his recitation of the judgment from the bench. And with regard to the negligent misrepresentation that was asked about, that cause of action is not mentioned in the judgment at the place where the court is making its findings. The only conceivable reference is the including but not limited to, but if you look at the rest of that laundry list, no finding is made by the court at that point in time that includes negligent misrepresentation. I can't imagine not knowing.
Am I missing something? Paragraph 3?
I'm sorry, Judge.
In the judgment? Default judgment, paragraph 3, on the claim of negligent misrepresentation, the court finds in favor of plaintiff?
That statement is in there, but when he makes the findings with regard to the damages on later in the judgment on paragraph 11, he doesn't have it there, but I acknowledge that he does make that statement in a judgment.
Okay. In fact, he grants judgment in favor of plaintiffs in the amount that's set out below. Okay.
With regard to the amount of the damages, I can't imagine not knowing. I can't imagine the uncertainty that they went through. I believe that the damage findings were reasonable by Judge Brotherton. I believe that he's the jurist that observed what these people went through or testified about, and I believe that the court should affirm the judgment and would request that the court do so.
All right, thank you, Mr. Stoller.
Thank you.
Stolle?
Just a couple of quick points. Counsel described Mr. Farmer's conduct as not tending to business. That simply shows a mistake or negligence, which is enough to satisfy the first credit factor. It shows some care, maybe not enough care, but some care to satisfy that factor. Counsel said that today is the first time he's heard the offer to reimburse for the cost to obtain the default judgment. We also made that offer in the reply brief that we filed a couple of weeks ago. And then counsel mentioned that from the bench, Judge Brotherton did recite individualized amounts for each plaintiff at the default hearing. He made oral findings at the default hearing. But when it came time to enter the judgment did not enter individualized awards. It specifically says it's an award for a collective unit. So there is no individualization in the judgment itself. And the judgment has to control over any oral statements by the court from the bench. Those oral statements are not formal findings of fact, and they certainly don't trump the written judgment, which awarded one lump sum as a collective unit.
What specifically is wrong with a judgment that awards something collectively to more than one plaintiff?
There can be a lot of things wrong. One of the things that's wrong here, for example, is the plaintiff who's a stepchild. Why would that plaintiff be entitled to recover at all? So what portion of the $850,000 given to them as a collective unit is her portion when she's not entitled to recover? Or what portion belongs to others of the Briscoe children who didn't even testify, who weren't there at the hearing? And there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that they suffered any mental anguish of any kind. Then the two Briscoe children who testified at the hearing didn't establish their own mental anguish. They certainly established that they were distraught to have to be in the courtroom, to have to testify, but that is different from the underlying conduct that allegedly caused the mental anguish. So at least with respect to the Briscoe children, we don't know what portion of that $850,000 collective unit award was actually allocated in the judge's mind to them. So there's no way to say that the judge gave that all to Mrs. Briscoe, even if her testimony was sufficient to establish her mental anguish. It was given to them collectively and not to her individually. So even if her mental anguish is sufficient to rise to compensable mental anguish, we don't know how much of that is hers. There's no way for this court to make that kind of finding, obviously, so it has to be resolved by trial on the merits.
Thank you, Mr. Steinmull, Mr. Stolle. We appreciate your arguments today and your briefing. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused. We will dismiss court now.